Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this December 2009 installment of Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening's confusion, Jim Campanella. I have a whole slew of different news items this evening, from the human interest to the obscure. So, let's get on with it. I'll start off with that human interest story. It's not so much hard science, but it's kind of interesting nonetheless, and certainly a bit unusual. You may have come across this one in your local newspaper because it involves someone selling something on eBay. And no, it was not a holy relic or anyone's virginity. Back in 2005, Anna McCallum was a research assistant aboard a seagoing marine biology laboratory out of Australia. The Southern Surveyor's nets, the name of the ship, trawl the ocean depths down to depths of 100 to 1,000 meters. And then they dumped their catches on board for McCallum and her colleagues to sift through. They were literally doing a survey of the species, all the species that could be found in the deep waters off the southwest coast of Australia. At some point in one of the 12-hour shifts that the researchers spent combing through the species that the nets found, Anna discovered a new species of shrimp. The shrimp was about 2 inches long and red-spotted and apparently quite attractive as far as shrimp go. Even though the researchers had already come across many new species, the shrimp stood out for its size and beauty. By discovering the shrimp, Miss McCallum earned the right to name it. She could have already done this several years gone by and named it after herself, as many researchers would have done, but she has held off. Anna is now a doctoral student at the University of Melbourne, and she decided a few months ago to auction off the right to name the new shrimp species to the highest bidder on eBay. Anna was not conducting the auction for her own profit, though. She hoped to accomplish a loftier goal, to raise money for marine conservation. She chose the popular website eBay to raise funds for the Australian Marine Conservation Society, AMCS, by auctioning off the right to name the new species. She said, quote, "I think eBay just seemed like an easy way to manage it and make it accessible to everyone. I thought it would be a good way to make money for marine conservation and for taxonomy in general." The auction got underway at the end of March, and McCallum watched intensely. She knew that a few of her friends would put up bids, so she thought she would end up getting at least $100 for the naming rights. By the end of the auction, days later, about 20 people had joined in. Bob Rosenberry, journalist and publisher of Shrimp News International, which follows world shrimp farming, was one of the more enthusiastic bidders. He said, quote, "I was attracted to the beauty of the specimen and the fact that someone could name it. Early on in the auction, I think I made a bid of about $2,000, and I was going to go up to $5,000. He planned to dub the species Lebius shrimpnewsii after his website, but then he learned he couldn't name it after a commercial entity, so he bowed out of the auction. The winner of the eBay auction with a bid of $3,600 Australian, that's about $2,900 US, was Luke Longley, a former NBA basketball player who won 3 straight league championships with the amazing Chicago Bull team of the 1990s. McCallum was completely surprised that an American quote-unquote basketballer would be interested in naming a little deep-sea shrimp. But Longley was no stranger to supporting marine conservation, having helped halt the construction of a resort near the Ningaloo Reef, a vast coral ecosystem off the west coast of Australia. And coincidentally, Longley is not American. He is from the Western Australian city of Fremantle, which is not all that far from where McCallum found the shrimp off the coast. Longley says that he was as excited to name the new shrimp species as he was to help the AMCS protect the marine environment. He named the shrimp Lebius clarehanna, as a birthday present to his eldest daughter, Claire Hannah Longley, who turned 15 this August. McCallum published a description of the new species and its name in a recent all-shrimp issue of the journal Zootaxa. The paper includes a description of another new shrimp species, Lebius cristagalli, which McCallum discovered on a 2007 Southern Surveyor cruise. She says she'll likely have more new species to discover as she studies the crustaceans off the coast of West Australia for her PhD thesis. I wish her luck. I'm sure she will do a great job and find some fascinating new little critters. It's always nice to see a scientist who is not a glory hound that wants to immortalize themselves. Okay, now from the human interest to the just plain strange. I came across this story by accident in the December issue of, this is the name of the journal, Harm Reduction Journal. I have never seen this journal before, and I assume that the raison d'etre of the journal is to, what, reduce harm? The journal article is called, quote, Cannabis as a Substitute for Cannabis and Other Drugs, and was written by Dr. Amanda Ryman of the School of Social Welfare at the University of California at Berkeley. As with many people in California, Dr. Ryman seems very interested in marijuana. Despite this commonality, I found the thesis of her article to be kind of interesting. Now, let me state here that Dr. Ryman's views do not necessarily represent those of the Starship Sofa, nor any of her crew, so do not make any assumptions here. Okay, so, Dr. Ryman suggested that cannabis is the ideal drug to give those who are already addicted to several other drugs, including alcohol, to wean them off of the more quote-unquote harmful drugs onto one that is quote-unquote more healthful. Let me quote from her paper to clarify. Quote, Substitution can be operationalized as the conscious choice to use one drug, legal or illicit, instead of or in conjunction with another due to issues such as perceived safety, level of addiction potential, effectiveness in relieving symptoms, or access and level of acceptance. This practice of substitution can be observed among individuals using cannabis for medical purposes, unquote. Basically, Ryman's study is designed to examine drug and alcohol use and the occurrence of substitution among medical cannabis patients where they use cannabis to help wean them off other substances. Mind you, before we get into this, I count this work as soft science because there was more than a bit of subjectiveness to the results, as you'll see. Ryman collected anonymous survey data at a medical cannabis dispensary in Berkeley, California. About 350 patients were examined. The sample was 68% male, 54% single, 66% white, mean age 39. 71% reported having a chronic medical condition, 52% used cannabis for a pain-related condition, and 75% used cannabis for a mental health issue. Here is a long and sad list of her findings. As I'm sure you have already guessed, she was not exactly dealing with a healthy group of people here. 53% of the sample currently drinks alcohol. 2.6 was the average number of drinking days per week. 2.9 was the average number of drinks on a drinking occasion. 1/4 currently uses tobacco. 9.5 is the average number of cigarettes smoked daily. 11% have used a non-prescribed, over-the-counter drug in the past 30 days with cocaine, MDMA, and Vicodin reported most frequently. 25% reported growing up in an abusive or addictive household. 16% reported previous alcohol and/or drug treatment. And 2% are currently in a 12-step or other recovery program. 40% have used cannabis as a substitute for alcohol, 26% as a substitute for illicit drugs, and 66% as a substitute for prescription drugs. The most common reasons given for substituting these drugs were 1. Less adverse side effects, 65%, 2. Better symptom management, 57%, and 3. Less withdrawal potential, 34%, with cannabis. Ryman concludes that since medical cannabis patients have already been engaging in substitution by using cannabis as an alternative to alcohol, prescription, and illicit drugs for years, it is probably a great idea for doctors and professionals to themselves substitute one psychoactive substance for another with the goal of quote-unquote harm reduction. Ha! I knew that she would get the name of the journal in there somewhere. Anyway, am I just being cynical or does this research seem just silly and discountable? I mean, seriously, isn't she saying the same thing as someone who says they did a marketing study and people say they prefer Pepsi to Coke or vice versa? Isn't she just saying here that in a marketing survey, drug users prefer cannabis to Coke? I almost feel like investigating whether she has financial ties to the medical marijuana industry. While we're on the subject of questionable psychological studies, try this one on for size. Dr. Nicholas Christakis of Harvard Medical School just published a paper this December in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. For those of you who do not recognize Christakis' name, let me jog your memories. He and Dr. James Fowler have conducted studies over the last couple of years to see how habits and feelings move through social networks. Their earlier controversial studies suggested that obesity, smoking, and happiness are all contagious from your friends and acquaintances. This new study, led by Dr. John Cacioppo of the University of Chicago, found that loneliness is catching as well, possibly because lonely people don't trust their connections and foster that mistrust in others. The study suggests that loneliness appears to be easier to catch from friends than from family, to spread more among women than men, and to be most contagious among neighbors who live within a mile of each other. The results indicate that lonely people tend to move to the peripheries of social networks, but first, lonely people transmit their feelings of isolation to their friends and neighbors. The study also found that loneliness can spread to 3 degrees of separation, just as in studies of obesity, smoking, and happiness show that. So one lonely friend makes you 40 to 65% more likely to be lonely, but a lonely friend of a friend increases your chances of loneliness by 14 to 36%. A friend of a friend of a friend adds between 6 and 26% to your likelihood of being lonely, the study suggests. Okay, this last one strikes me as utterly absurd. From a practical standpoint, do you even know what the psychological state of a friend of yours is? Do you even think that there is a 14% chance that a remote friend's status affects you? How about a friend of a friend of a friend? Even that remote 6% chance strikes me as a sheer statistical coincidence. And now using Occam's razor, isn't it more likely that effects like this can be accounted for by common environmental influences or the tendency of similar people to befriend each other? That is, lonely people in this case. Just to show you how weak the evidence is for these particular conclusions by Christakis' group, Dr. Jason Fletcher recently responded with his own study to show that, listen, acne, headaches, and height also appear to spread through computer networks. Since these things cannot be spread physically, it suggests other explanations are at work here, which makes sense in these cases. But people will be quicker to believe the psychological examples like loneliness and happiness. Okay, just to make me feel better, let's finish the night off with a couple of hard science stories. So the next story has to do with ants, but only secondarily. So it's barely an ant story, okay? It's actually a story about caterpillars. For the last several months, we've been discussing ant communication, and most of the communication that we talked about was based on chemical signals of some kind. But we did mention that ants employ sound as well, sometimes to the detriment of the ants themselves. Maculana butterflies parasitize ants, and some Maculana species treat their hosts as a larder, raiding and consuming the ants' brood, while other butterfly species mimic ant larvae to trick the workers into feeding them, just like cuckoos. The question of scientists has always been, why do the ants put up with this and not attack the caterpillars in their nests? Well, in this month's issue of the Journal of Experimental Biology, Dr. Kartsen Schoenroge from the Center for Ecology and Hydrology in the UK and his colleagues answer what protects the caterpillars. They found that Maculana caterpillars make a sound like an ant queen, and the ants behave like her courtiers, even though she isn't there. According to Dr. Schoenroge, the caterpillars are such convincing mimics that they're able to trick ants into believing that they are larvae so that worker ants rescue the caterpillars before they even rescue their own young when under attack. Analyzing the recordings, the team could see that the main difference between worker and queen ants' buzzes was in their pitch. Workers have a high-pitched buzz of about 1,400 hertz, while the queens buzz at about 800 hertz, and butterfly pupae all buzz at about 800. The pupae were mimicking the queens to raise their status in the worker ants' eyes and ensure that they get fed first, or that they can feed on the ants for that matter, depending on the caterpillar species. Schoenroge says that what he finds most surprising is that the ants and caterpillars are able to produce such similar buzzes, given their differences in size and the instruments that they use. The final story of the night is kind of complicated, so try to keep up with me. It has to do with cancer and genes, and was reported by Dr. Tyler Jacks and his MIT research team in the November issue of the Journal of Genes and Development. First, some basic genetics. Your genome is made up of half DNA from your mother and half from your father. Yes, that seems simple, but bear with me. Many genetic diseases arise when you get a bad or recessive gene from your mother and another bad gene from your father, If you have two copies of these recessive or bad genes and not a good one to balance it off, then you will get the disease. If you get a good gene from one parent and a bad recessive gene from the other, then you are balanced and do not get the disease. This is called a heterozygote state. All of us are heterozygotes for dozens of potentially lethal genes. For many years, geneticists who specialize in cancer research have believed that one possible mutation that can lead to cancer is what is called a, quote, loss of heterozygosity, unquote. It was thought that if you are a heterozygote and your one good gene is knocked out in a cell and becomes a mutant, well, then that could seriously hurt the cell. If you're dealing with a gene like a cancer suppressor gene that protects you against tumor development, then cancer will often be the result of a loss of heterozygosity. Loss of heterozygosity is a real phenomenon, and it's been observed over and over again. But it turns out that if you have a good working copy of a gene, you can actually be worse off than if you don't have one. I mean, there are times when nothing is actually better than a half measure, as in a heterozygote. So Dr. Tyler Jacks and his team found that the loss of one copy of a regulatory gene called DICER1 is enough to turn tumors deadly, while losing both copies can actually stop the cancer from growing. I mean, the finding is a surprise because normally cells have to lose both copies of a tumor suppressor gene before cancer can start. One working copy is usually enough to protect the cells. Jack's results suggest that many other genes that have not been characterized and are working at half capacity may actually accelerate tumor growth. DICER is a protein that helps literally slice long pieces of the genetic material RNA into small bits known as microRNAs. Despite their small size, these microRNAs are now known to play a big role in controlling lots of cell functions, including regulating when and where proteins are made. And recently, microRNAs have even been implicated in several types of cancer. Mice predisposed to lung cancer got more tumors when the researchers removed one copy of the DICER gene from their lung cells. Surprisingly, mice lacking both copies of the genes in their lungs actually did better than mice with a single copy of the gene. The same results were true for mice with another type of cancer called soft tissue sarcoma. Mice entirely lacking DICER1 survived better than mice with one working copy of the gene. Dr. Jack says, quote, "DICER may be an example of an unusual type of tumor suppressor, one in which losing only one copy of a gene can promote tumor growth. We are calling this a haploinsufficient tumor suppressor," unquote. Presumably what Jax means is that two copies of the gene protect cells from cancer, but incapacitating one copy of a gene is enough to support tumor growth. Personally, I'm not thrilled with Jack's term. It implies that a single copy of the gene should protect against cancer. And isn't that exactly the opposite of what his data shows? The term is just confusing. Anyway, as I said, many other genes, most not involved with microRNA processing, may also lead to more aggressive tumors when one copy is knocked out. Searches for cancer genes usually look for genes that follow the classical model, that is, requiring both the copies to be lost to induce cancer. Jack says the searches for those cancer genes should be refined to take into account genes like DICER1 that promote cancer when only one single copy is lost. Even if researchers find other such genes, these genes may not follow DICER's pattern when both copies are lost. That's because microRNAs are so crucial to the cell's functioning that losing DICER1 or other parts of the manufacturing machinery could be disastrous for both healthy cells and tumor cells. Other genes may not be as crucial for cell survival as DICER1. By the way, please note that this research does not offer any immediate solutions for cancer treatment or therapy or cures. It's not likely that the researchers are going to go in soon with guns blazing and wipe out both copies of genes in tumor cells. The problem is that knocking out those genes could prove toxic to healthy cells, and the alternative of replacing a missing copy of the gene is not yet very practical. We're still working on the problem of human gene transformation. It'll be a while yet before we can inject any gene we want into a human to replace a missing gene that doesn't function correctly. That has been the goal for years with diabetics, and we're still working on that process. Well, that's all for me from now. As always, take care, stay away from sad sacks on Facebook, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.